when you peel back the layers, you realize it's just a couple of super wealthy individuals that are funding these, and I think it makes a difference.
A push from Alaska for stronger federal campaign finance disclosure laws. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaska groups assess the reworked healthcare.gov website.
I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, it's operating at about a 7. Our enrollment numbers are coming up dramatically.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Over the next year, millions of dollars are expected to enter Alaska in the form of campaign spending. The Alaska Senate race could end up being one of the more expensive races in the country because Republicans need to unseat Democrat Mark Begich if they want to take control of Congress. Since much of the money is going to be spent on political ads, some state legislators would like to see stronger federal disclosure laws so voters know who's paying for the airtime. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
If you spend any time watching local television, there's a good chance you've seen this during a commercial break.
For too many of us, costs are going way up. Senator Begich didn't listen. How can I ever trust him again? It just isn't fair. Alaska deserves better.
Call Senator Begich. Tell him no more broken promises. Stop Obamacare.
The ad was put together by the conservative advocacy group Americans for Prosperity, and it's been criticized for being filmed in a lower 48 kitchen and for featuring a Maryland actress. But Democratic state legislators Hollis French and Les Guerra have a bigger beef with the ad than the shooting location. They think it should name the organization who paid for it and who their top donors are. Here's French.
When you peel back the layers, you realize it's just a couple of super wealthy individuals that are funding these. And I think it makes a difference if their names have to be read as being the person funding the advertisement.
In the case of Americans for Prosperity, that would be Texas billionaires David and Charles Koch.
And then it'd be, you know, the first Koch brother, the second Koch brother, and then they'd probably run out of donors unless they've got some third person to throw in some money.
French and Guerra held a small rally to draw attention to the issue today in Anchorage, and they plan to introduce a resolution this upcoming legislative session that would ask Congress to pass stronger disclosure laws. They want to see something like the so-called Disclose Act, which was introduced after the Supreme Court decided corporations had the right to make campaign expenditures. That bill would have put a number of limits on corporations. One of the measures in it would have made interest groups list their donors at the end of attack ads, something that's already required at the state level in Alaska. The bill lost momentum in Congress after being filibustered in the Senate. But French wants Congress to revisit the law, so campaign ads in federal races are treated the same as ads in state races.
Come on, Congress. You know, we could do it. You can do it.
Alaska's congressional delegation is largely on board. Senator Mark Begich originally supported the Disclose Act, and Senator Lisa Murkowski has introduced separate legislation that would tighten rules for political action committees. Representative Don Young voted against the Disclose Act and stands by that vote. For its part, Virginia-based Americans for Prosperity doesn't like the Disclose Act. They think their donors could be harassed or face other negative consequences for supporting their group, which in turn would limit their speech. President Tim Phillips also thinks that Guerra and French are raising the issue as a way of deflecting negative attention from a fellow Democrat.
They've had years to talk about this other topic, right? And then all of a sudden they bring it up just as we start holding the senator accountable for his Obamacare vote. I mean, unfortunately, this is kind of how politics works too often.
And as far as the ad with the Maryland actress, Phillips is standing by it. He says it's the message that matters and that Alaskans should expect to see more spots like it on television going into campaign season.
I think you're going to see additional ads coming from us.
As for whether those will be filmed in Alaska, Phillips says that hasn't been decided yet. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Groups in Alaska working to sign people up for health insurance on the federal marketplace say the website is working much better. The Obama administration relaunched an improved healthcare.gov marketplace yesterday. Now insurance agents and navigators have 3 weeks to help Alaskans enroll in insurance plans that start offering coverage January 1st. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Tyanne Bowling probably knows healthcare.gov better than any other Alaskan. And the COO of Enroll Alaska is not shy about grading the website. In October, on a scale of 1 to 10, she gave it a 1. In November, a 4. And now?
I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, it's operating about a 7. Our enrollment numbers are coming up dramatically.
Bowling says yesterday her insurance agents enrolled 14 people in the marketplace, a figure that was unthinkable a few weeks ago. She says the process usually takes around 45 minutes, but the website needs work. Bowling says her agents still encounter technical issues, especially with the more complicated cases.
I can't pinpoint one situation that is really the main problem. It's just the complexity of people's lives that can make it more challenging to get people enrolled, or maybe it's a time where they're working on one part of the system and so for some reason that doesn't work.
When problems do pop up, Bowling says her agents are usually able to work through them instead of sending clients home. Another big difference from the old website. Susan Johnson is the regional director of the Federal Health and Human Services Department. She says she's aware the site still needs attention.
We're working every day with teams 24/7 to get to a 10.
Johnson wants people who gave up on healthcare.gov in the early months to give it a try again.
It is a continuous progress. We didn't get to December 1st and say we're done. We're going to get to December 23rd and continue to work through improving this site all the way through March and beyond.
December 23rd is the date people need to be enrolled in insurance to have coverage by January 1st. The open enrollment period extends through March 31st. The Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center has 3 people working to sign up Alaskans for insurance, but the clinic says about a third of the people they help earn too little to qualify for subsidies to buy insurance. Under the Affordable Care Act, they should be eligible for Medicaid, but Governor Sean Parnell declined federal funds to expand the program. Development Director John Zazada says that puts the center in a tough spot.
The work that we do in providing primary care does not equal having access to quality insurance. For us and for, we think, you know, other community health centers around the state, this does amount to an unfunded mandate to serve patients that could otherwise have quality care.
Alaskans who would have qualified for Medicaid under the expansion can apply for a hardship exemption so they don't have to pay a penalty for being uninsured. Overall, the main groups assisting Alaskans with healthcare.gov have enrolled just 96 people since October 1st. They hope that number will increase substantially in the next few weeks. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a different approach to reviving a native language.
All it really takes is dedication to the language. It doesn't even take fluency because you can be learning with your children.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
Hundreds of dead birds washed up on the shores of St. Lawrence Island toward the end of November. And though the cause of the die-off isn't yet known, the quick response demonstrates a mounting capacity for dealing with unexpected environmental events in the region. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports from Nome.
Gay Sheffield is the Marine Advisory Program agent at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Northwest Campus in Nome. She was sent a sample of the birds after they started showing up November 20th on beaches near Savunga.
3 birds were sent in right away on the day that the birds were washing in, and the 3 birds were an auklet, a murre, and a northern fulmar, which is like a offshore seagull.
No one knows yet what caused so many birds to die out at sea. And to make matters more confusing, most of the species recovered on St. Lawrence Island have usually migrated south by mid-November. Sheffield says people in Gambell and Savunga began contacting her immediately once they found birds washing ashore in such high numbers.
They packaged up the birds, some good samples, whole birds that were freshly dead, and put them in a cooler, and they sent them COD into Nome. The three birds that were sent in from Savunga have been sent to the National Wildlife Health Center, and they will get us some results later this week.
The most likely explanation for the sudden die-off is weather. Sheffield thinks that the unseasonably warm fall might have kept migratory species like murres and auklets from heading south on schedule. The birds were from several different species, and most were plump and young, making sickness an unlikely culprit. Instead, violent winds and the rapid onset of frigid temperatures was probably what killed so many of the animals. According to Sheffield, the fast response by residents of St. Lawrence Island is part of a strengthening regional self-sufficiency when it comes to handling environmental crises.
We've had a series of unfortunate events, scares with sick seals, oiled seals, and whatnot. A regional response has provided the most rapid interface with the medical community. We're able to get the word to the laboratories in the major hubs.
In the last few years, regional officials have relied on local residents for news of sick wildlife. The partnerships and lines of communications developed amid those events are especially important as federal money and resources for environmental response are diminishing. Barbara Bodenstein is a wildlife disease specialist at the USGS National Wildlife Health Center, the same lab in Wisconsin where the three sample birds were FedExed from Nome. She explained that her agency has had to scale back on field work and travel because of federal budget cuts. The center helps states and tribes with disease investigations, and Bodenstein said that receiving specimens like those from St. Lawrence Island a mere 2 days after their discovery is ideal for their work in the lab. The USGS National Wildlife Health Center should have the findings from their investigation as early as this week. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Reports of deformed frogs and toads in the mid-90s prompted Congress to mandate studies to look into the problem. Amphibians are sort of the canary in the coal mine for gauging the environmental health of land and surface water. The study was released in November and looks at amphibian abnormalities on 152 wildlife refuges across the country, including five in Alaska. The decade-long study by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service examined more than 68,000 frogs and toads. Generally, only about 2% of the amphibians were found to have abnormal limbs, but there were a few areas called hot spots where the rates were much higher. Two of those areas were in South Central and Eastern Alaska. Mary Reeves is an ecologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service. She says they wanted to see if the hot spots had something to do with people.
And we found a strong and significant association between the abnormalities and road proximity. So if you were lived closer to a road, you were more likely to be abnormal. And it was a probabilistic thing, meaning that if you live next to a road, you were not always abnormal. Like, we definitely had collection events right next to roads that we didn't find any abnormal frogs, but what we found is that the average frequency went up. And
the abnormal frogs were found in greatest numbers in the Kenai and Tetlin refuge areas. Anwar, Inoko, Yukon Delta, and other refuges that were sampled had much lower rates. Reeves says the connection to abnormal frogs and toads could in part be linked to copper in brake linings. When you hit the brakes, a bit of the copper grinds off the brake lining and settles on the roadway. Reeves says incredibly low amounts of copper can impact a tadpole's ability to avoid predators, and dragonfly larvae like to eat tadpole limbs. If they bite them off during the tadpole's early growth, they can grow back, but they might not look the same.
And depending on the complexity of how that wound happens, you can get some really more interesting malformations, like split limbs or limbs that where they're called bony triangles in the limb. And if it's just a clean break, then you might just get one limb that looks like a normal limb, except that it's smaller than the other ones. Those are the really common abnormality types.
Reeves says another fairly common abnormality specific to Alaska frogs is one called black eye or a hollow eye, where the normal gold color around the iris is gone. Researchers don't know if the frogs can still see through that eye. Reeves says legacy toxins were another problem for frogs. Pesticides such as lindane, used to kill spruce bark beetles, or contaminants that drift to northern climates from other places and drop in snowfall cause toxin accumulation through global distillation. Reeves says multiple stressors likely caused the hot spots for abnormalities.
We think that we understand at least a bit of how that mechanism works, is that very low levels of contaminants can make the tadpoles sick, can make the tadpoles not as well able to get away from their predator who's bite the legs off, and so you get these the limb abnormalities.
She says the study is the largest data set in the world on this amphibian issue, although the testing was only conducted on wildlife refuges. You can find links to the research at our website, alaskapublic.org. A Delta Junction area farmer is rebuilding after a barn fire that killed 500 chickens and other livestock last spring. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports farmer Brandy McLean is determined to restore her poultry operation.
2013 has not been a good year for Brandy McLean. In April, she lost her barn and the chickens, turkeys, and ducks that were trapped inside. She's stayed in business since then by growing crops and raising hogs, and has begun rebuilding the barn with the help of her father and friends. Then, in September, her father died.
It's been a rough year, one heck of a year, you know, and just, it's been about probably the worst year of my life, but we're not going to give up.
And that pretty much sums up McLean's attitude.
Mom and Dad didn't raise me to sit around crying. You get out and you do it, you know.
The 38-year-old single mom with two boys has been doing just that over the past several weeks, plugging away in a kind of slow-motion barn raising while running the farm. Friends helped her frame up the 16-by-20 structure a couple of weeks ago.
I mean, you can actually see it now. It's looking great.
McLean had hoped to have the barn done by now, but she says it's tough to get volunteer help to show up due to the storms and cold snaps over the past few weeks. She's got a few dozen chickens free roaming right now, and some that she's farmed out to others, but she's pretty much resigned to waiting until spring to get back into the poultry business.
I've got stock running around, living with the hogs, you know, but no, I mean, I was hoping by now I'd have it to be able to be laying eggs and think that's part of my business, so it's kind of slowed things down some, you know.
McLean is mostly getting by right now by selling hogs and produce. She attended a farmer's market in Tok over the weekend, a chance to make a little cash and remind everyone that Triple McLean Farms is still up and running.
We grew a lot this year as far as whole crops and root crops and things like that, and was able to sell a lot of that, supplement with baked goods. I've been doing that, and that's I'm going to the Tok Bazaar here on Saturday. I'm going down to do that, sell potatoes and some baked goods and things. But it lets people know that, hey, yeah, we had a fire, but we are still in business.
McLean says she and some volunteers will get back to work on the barn after Thanksgiving. She's planning to give more thanks to everyone who's helped out on the project by throwing a big barbecue next summer. And she says that fried chicken will definitely be on the menu. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Fairbanks emergency responders rescued a woman from a window of a downtown Fairbanks high-rise yesterday. Fairbanks Police Lieutenant Matt Soden says police got a call about the woman in an open window on the eighth floor of the Northward apartment building Monday morning.
We responded over there, made contact from the doorway with a female who was having some mental health issues. She was very scared, thought that people were after her, and she was climbing out the window to make an escape. We began talking with her, trying to convince her to come back in, while at the same time the fire department responded and set up their ladder truck with a large bucket underneath her. And as she either slipped or started to fall, they were able to get a hold of her and get her into the bucket.
Lieutenant Soden says the woman only fell about a foot and was not injured, but was transported to the hospital. He says family members also responded. The lower 48 has been on the offensive against the flu virus for weeks, but in Unalaska, most people didn't have access to vaccines until late November. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, an attempt to tailor flu prevention around Unalaska's unique population didn't go over well with the locals.
Kathy Whitman has lived in Unalaska for years, and in that time, she's learned not to take chances with her health.
Out here, it's really kind of a concern because if you get sick, you're pretty much looking at a trip off the island. You know, you're having to go to Anchorage to get fixed.
That's why Whitman tries to get a flu shot as early as she can every year, typically in October. But when she called the Iliuk Family and Health Services Clinic asking about her vaccine this year, Whitman was told she'd have to wait all the way through November.
I don't think that this was a wise choice to be made. You know, they're taking a chance with our health. And if it was just my health, but it's the whole community, you know. Once one person gets it, it kind of goes like wildfire generally.
While there is a risk in skipping a vaccine or waiting too long to get it, Clinic Director Eileen Conlon-Scott says the flu shot can wear off.
Every year we end up with a lot of people getting the flu at the end of the season because they get inoculated too early.
And Clinical Director Ramona Thompson says Unalaskans could wait until Christmas and still be protected.
Honestly, it wouldn't even bother me if it didn't come until then. I mean, it would probably bother the community, but I don't feel like it's a concern until, you know, the processing plants start ramping up.
Thompson says Unalaska's flu season happens later than in the lower 48, usually from January through April. That lines up with the processing A season, when lots of workers come to town from out of state and possibly bring illnesses with them. Even though clinic staff had a reason for giving out vaccines later this year, they didn't notify patients that they were changing the schedule. Scott says she got at least 10 calls in October from locals like Kathy Whitman, who wanted to know when they'd be able to get their shots. And not everyone could wait. Some of the school's highest-risk employees were inoculated by a visiting nurse in early November. And some kids under 18 who were also at risk got their vaccines on time from a stockpile at the clinic. One other high-risk group is the seafood processors, the people who clinic staff say might be a driving force behind Unalaska's flu season. Unice is the biggest processing plant in Unalaska. To cut down on sickness, they're running a mini-flu clinic out of their office here and at company headquarters in Washington State. But not everyone participates, and Unice's Human Resources Director Michelle Cochran says they don't require employees to get vaccinated before they start work. So it's pretty much a given that some people are going to get sick.
Every year, you know, there's some sort of illness that goes on, and I think a big part of that is just people entering a new environment. You know, who knows what they're bringing with them.
Cochran's also on the board of directors for the Iliuk Clinic. While the board didn't have a part in the decision to offer flu shots a little later this year, Cochran says she thought it made sense. And the clinic's not giving up on the idea that a later vaccine could be better, but next year they're going to give patients an option. The clinic will be prepared to give flu shots starting in October, but they'll be recommending people wait until November, so they'll be protected from getting sick when it really counts. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Speaking an endangered language at home is the essence of language revitalization, according to author Leanne Hinton. She's written the book Bringing Our Languages Home and was recently in Juneau for a Tlingit conference. KTOO's Lisa Fu spoke to Hinton and to a Juneau mother who's trying it out.
Misha Jackson and her husband are speaking Tlingit to their 10-month-old baby, Michaelin.
We do little words and phrases and commands at home and try to expose her as much as she can to the elders that speak conversationally so she can just hear it. She loves to hear it, so it gets her attention better than English does.
Jackson herself doesn't speak the language well. Her family has roots in Klukwan, but Jackson grew up in Anchorage, then lived in Southern California. Her mother taught her Tlingit songs, and that's about it. By speaking Tlingit at home, Jackson wants to give her daughter something she didn't have. Jackson's husband, on the other hand, was exposed to the language growing up in Cake.
Her dad got to listen to his grandparents, and he's a much better speaker because of it, whereas for me, I can't make the same sounds as easily as he can, so I know it makes a huge difference.
Jackson is doing exactly what Leanne Hinton recommends for parents who may not speak a language but want to make it a part of their home.
All it really takes is dedication to the language. It doesn't even take fluency because you can be learning with your children. Like many of the families I know started from scratch when their children were already born. And as they learned, they were bringing it home bit by bit and making it more and more the language of their home.
Hinton is Professor Emeritus of Language at the University of California, Berkeley. She specialized in American Indian languages, sociolinguistics, and language loss and revival. She's written a number of books on keeping endangered languages alive and says speaking the native language at home is the key. Home, she says, is the last place where it disappeared.
To get it back into the home again is the one time that the language is actually going to become naturally acquired again by children so that actual native speakers are occurring. Once people are learning it at home and using it, then you feel like you're beginning to be out of danger for the language.
Hinton says ideally, parents would only speak the endangered language at home, but that's usually not the case.
Most of the people that I've interviewed are lucky if they use it 50% of the time. And 50% of the time is actually a fairly good ratio, but you want more for an endangered language if possible.
Parents like Jackson, who speak their native language at home, will likely face some challenges when their children go to school and their peers and teachers are speaking English. Hinton says children may then refuse to speak the native language at home, but there are ways to tackle this problem.
One way is to start trying to talk about how important it is to use the language, but that may not go over with a five-year-old. Some parents just simply won't respond to their kids if the kids talk to them in English. They'll talk to the kids in their endangered language, and if the kids talk back in English, they'll just say, "I don't understand." Sometimes that works quite well.
Another option is making language a game. Imagine jars with pennies inside. Every family member gets one. If a person catches another saying something in English that could be said in their indigenous language, that person gets to take a penny out of the other's jar and put it into their own jar. At this point, Jackson doesn't have to worry about those challenges yet. She says her daughter, Michaelyn, isn't saying much in English or in Tlingit.
Every once in a while we laugh because it sounds like she says kla, like she's saying hukla. So we crack up whenever she does that.
That's Tlingit for gee whiz. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had help tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Tim Ellis in Tok, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.